Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. I'm your host, Lance Thurner. This week, we're going to be talking with Professor Megan Finn about her new book, Documenting Aftermath, Information Infrastructures in the Wake of Disasters, out in 2018 by MIT Press. Documenting Aftermath is a fascinating examination of how information infrastructures shape the ways that we know and learn about disasters. Finn uses three historical case studies, major earthquakes in Northern California in 1868, 1906, and 1989, to reflect upon the development of private and public information services and how these succeed and fail to inform local and distant audiences about disaster realities. This is a very timely book, for as global warming promises more frequent catastrophes, social media and government information systems increasingly dictate how information moves. More than ever, it is necessary to question this arrangement and the oversights, inequalities, and possibilities for abuse of power therein. Thus, I am very happy to be sharing
Professor Megan Finn, welcome to New Books in
Science, Technology, and Society.
Thanks so much.
It's great to have you here. So to begin talking about your book, Documenting Aftermath, I'd like to know a little bit about where this idea came from and the genesis of the project.
Sure. I guess these projects always have a short story and a long story. And so the short story is, like many folks after Hurricane Katrina, I was pretty shocked and horrified by what happened, and was beginning my grad school career and just started reading all of the reports generated by the government and nonprofits and other academics coming out afterwards, and was pretty interested in the role that information was playing rhetorically in a lot of these reports. It was this sort of boogeyman that was blamed for the poor response often. It sort of caused me to ask a lot of questions about what the role of information was in disaster response. And of course, I was living in Berkeley, California at the time, which is a place where hazards and risk and disasters are well known. And so I decided to turn my attention to thinking about earthquakes in that area. And of course, you know, the longer story involves, many, many grad seminars and lots of people that I was thinking with at the time, who particularly Paul Duguid, and who's thinks about histories of information. So that sort of turned my attention to the more historical cases, but also thinking with people like Gene Lee, who's an amazing ethnographer who is in the geography department at Berkeley, and was teaching all these classes, thinking about practice, and so starting to think about, okay, what does information practice look like? And there are lots of sort of more complex ways in which my specific orientation to the project developed. But yeah, it was really born out of concerns after Katrina, and a trip that I took down there with journalism students to about a year after the hurricane to document what had happened, and sort of thinking with them about how to do that work and what that would look like in the Bay Area.
Yeah. Can you describe just a little bit about what you observed about the structure of information in New Orleans during and after Hurricane Katrina?
Yeah, I mean, briefly, again, this was not, and did not end up being the sort of focus of my work. But yeah, I mean, one thing that was very striking was particularly in the federal reports around Hurricane Katrina, there was this sort of constant theme that people did not have the information that they needed to be making decisions. And, you know, and various entities were sort of blamed for that. The media, of course, you know, faulty communication networks. But yeah, this ended up being this sort of source of, real angst for particularly the federal government, in my reading of things. And then, of course, you get to, New Orleans where, you know, I was with journalists and hear stories about, how people survived the hurricane, and it's very different than what was heard on the federal level and through the media. And sort of simultaneously, there was a lot of, you know, this, and again, it's like 2005 and the internet is still feeling a little bit new. We're sort of like a decade or so into having the World Wide Web. There were some really interesting experiments going on where people were collecting the names of people who had survived the hurricane and posting them on various websites. And there was some cool efforts to try to come up with standards to describe people and, centralize these lists together. So there's sort of some interesting emerging practices around, the web and how it could be used in these spaces. And also this sort of simultaneous blaming of the incredibly poor federal disaster response on lack of information. So those sort of two trends struck me as really interesting.
Yeah. So as you started to shape up your project, then you decided to take a historical look. And here, in documenting aftermath, we have three earthquakes in Northern California of 1868, 1906, and 1989. How did you choose these particular events to look at, and what does a historical perspective bring to these questions about what information, how information travels in the wake of disaster?
Yeah. Initially, I did actually a lot of work on Southern California as well, and that ended up being published in articles and work outside of the book. I decided to focus on Northern California and this sort of paradigmatic earthquakes that had occurred in that space, in part because, of course, I was living there and had access to easy access to a lot of the archival documents I wanted to focus on within the region. But also because Northern California, the public imagination was this space of, you know, seismic activity and danger. That was sort of very interesting to me. So there's like some real pragmatic reasons to focus on Northern California. But also it was, you know, sort of an easy fit into the public imagination of what it what it feels like to live with earthquakes. As far as taking a historical turn, and, you know, I sit in this unusual interdisciplinary department, that's like has its roots in library and information sciences. So, you know, doing historical work is not, typical, I guess, in this space, although there's a lot of really great historians working in these information school programs. It was partially influenced by the fact that I wanted to work on disasters affecting my community. And I wanted to focus on people's actual practices rather than sort of imaginations of what might happen, which were sort of contained in disaster response plans. And that sort of naturally required, a historical lens. I also was working with, Paul Duguid very closely. Throughout my dissertation work, and he was teaching this really wonderful class at Berkeley called the History of Information, which I TA'd and, you know, taught in the summer period. You know, that really kind of piqued my interest in sort of questioning a lot of the claims throughout the sort of utopian 2000s, a lot of claims around, you know, how the internet was changing our lives and this has never happened before. And, you know, all of these sort of claims that we hear and wanting to look to the past to say, hey, you know, are these claims correct? and, you know, as in a sort of very instrumental way, but then also, you know, this interest in institutions and how institutions shape information practices, and looking towards a comparative historical lens as a way of, you know, understanding what's going on today. And also, you know, understanding sort of how power and the sort of various arrangements of institutions, shape knowledge and knowledge practices after disasters. It's sort of a longish answer, but
yeah. So just leading off that last thing you were saying, and a large part of this book is about how these systems and these infrastructures create what you call like earthquake publics.
Yeah.
You know, what does that mean to talk about a public, an earthquake public like this?
Yeah. So one of the big arguments of the book is that these public information infrastructures bring these earthquake publics into being. And, you know, I guess my interest in talking about them both with the lens of public information infrastructures, you know, and I'm drawing heavily from science and technology studies work about information infrastructures in order to sort of create this conceptual apparatus, is to sort of think about how our understandings of information infrastructures as a sort of, you know, these heterogeneous networks of technologies and institutions and peoples and practices and, you know, the physical earth around us, how to think about, you know, these theories that had been primarily utilized within the STS space to study scientific practice, how that would be useful to understand publics and sort of non-experts and, you know, sort of different arrangements of people. So that was sort of how I got interested in thinking about publics, is through this conceptual kind of rethinking of information infrastructures.
Sure. So, you know, one of the advantages of taking this historical perspective of towards these questions is how it denaturalizes us from what we expect to see around us. You know, the role of the government, especially in shaping information about disasters, is so large now, and sometimes it's hard to remember there was a time before social media. Let's go back to 1868 then. Okay. So how did people find out about this earthquake, and what were the structures that shaped the way that information moved?
Yeah, so 1868 was an important case for me because it was this time before there was a formalized disaster response and, you know, federal involvement, you know, national government involvement in California was pretty minimal at this point as compared to in the later earthquakes. So in 1868, you know, a lot of, there were telegraphic infrastructures in place. However, they were fairly new. The cross-continental telegraph was really, again, sort of fairly new, less than, you know, a couple years old. And the telegraphic infrastructure was primarily for business use. It wasn't for everyday people to be, you know, communicating with mom and dad back home. It was far too expensive and, you know, priced very specifically so businesses could use it for their work. And so most people were communicating with their families with, you know, letters. And again, there's, you know, this is only 2 decades after, the revision of a lot of the, postal pricing laws and regulations, So, you know, it become cheaper for middle class people to send letters back home, you know, fairly recently. So that's sort of the main, you know, and of course, newspapers within specific geographic spaces are publishing both letters and telegraphs, and these are sort of the main organs of these earthquake publics at this point. One thing that I got super interested in this case, you know, and again, we, you know, sort of situating this book in these cases within the larger histories of like newspaper norms, right? This is 1868. So again, it's before the emergence of this sort of objective journalism practices that we, you know, might think of in the later earthquakes. And, you know, at this point, the sort of rise in newspapers in California has been astronomical. There's, you know, new newspapers are sort of coming on the scene and dying at a very regular rate during the 1850s and 1860s. And, you know, anybody can kind of, you know, not anybody, but, you know, many people are sort of getting their hands on a printing press and maybe printing a few issues of a newspaper and seeing if it works out and seeing if it sticks. So you have these newspapers that are telling the story of what happened in their regional spaces and, of course, relying on the telegraph to learn about what's happened around the state, you know, but also telling stories that, you know, serve their ends. Be they, you know, the sort of pro-business bias of some of the San Francisco newspapers, or when it's, you know, more sensationalizing papers that are just aiming to sell, or, you know, maybe really serving the sort of very small communities in their interests. So you get in these sort of very, I think sort of the contemporary lens of misinformation is kind of fun to think through. In this 1868 case, where there are these sort of very intense debates where, you know, newspapers are accusing each other of lying about the damage in different areas. And there's this sort of interest in not being the area that was the most affected by the earthquake, and saying, oh, you know, the damage was worse over there. You know, this is in part for commercial interests that people don't want to, you know, they want to remain a space that's safe for investment of Eastern dollars and a safe place for immigrants to be coming to and, you know, laboring there. So there's sort of these local competitions between the newspapers telling the stories. And, you know, at the same time, you have, of course, a physical earthquake has occurred and there's real damage done to the local papers and the telegraph networks. And there's sort of interesting ways in which the damage to these you know, newspaper offices or telegraphic networks, the damage itself becomes a sort of interesting source with which to interpret what has happened in different places. So, and, you know, the sort of damage in some sense allows for this, spread of rumor or misinformation or whatever you want to call it. Because it allows people to sort of fill in with their imaginations when they can't get in touch with a place, then, oh, it must have been, you know, really bad. Or if they're not hearing back on telegrams that they're sending, it must be really bad. So, yeah, so it's sort of this really interesting, very robust, you know, space of information sharing, but with very different means than we have today.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, one of the interesting things that comes up, you know, right from this chapter, but also from the others, is that the disasters remind us of the materiality of these systems of communication that are so often invisible to us. And one of the things that you write in each of these chapters, but specifically this one, is about how these reinforce certain inequalities and in the wake of disasters, it's those with the access to the capital to fix these systems that are able to rebound most quickly.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, so in 1868 and then much more so in the 1906 chapter, I'm looking, so, you know, 1906 is like the big earthquake, you know, that looms large in the sort of California imagination. And of course, for those who are familiar with the story, the earthquake breaks a lot of the water mains in the city. And after this huge earthquake, fires start that end up burning for 4 days and burn down half of the city. And, you know, half of San Francisco's population is displaced. So this is like the big earthquake. You know, the major newspapers in San Francisco burned to the ground in the 1906 earthquake. Most of the telegraphic infrastructure in downtown San Francisco, which is this, you know, busy business, West Coast business metropolis at this point, burned down. It's fairly remarkable sort of how quickly people are able to continue their work practices, even with this absolutely destroyed physical infrastructure, in order to sort of keep reproducing this information order. And again, these sort of dominant institutions with deep pockets are the ones that can pay employees to come to work the day after an earthquake, and to sort of keep working to remake this infrastructure into something that's, you know, quote unquote working, even when much of it has been destroyed. So yeah, in 1868, this is also true. In 1906, the sort of particular power structures, relations of power that are involved in producing this information order, are very, very clear. And I think it's almost sort of astonishing in some sense that, these major newspapers are able to put out, you know, after having their entire buildings burned to the ground, probably the residences of, most of their reporters and staff are destroyed, they're able to put out a paper the next day. It's just sort of incredible. These really deep pocketed institutions are able to recover quickly, despite the destruction of these physical, the sort of physical manifestations of these public information infrastructures. The work practices of employees, how people organize their work, are really retained and maintained, despite all of that.
Yeah, I want to pick up on something you just said, which is that after disasters, we see not so much effort at creating new models or networks or technologies of communication, but rather energies are focused on rebuilding what was. I suppose in a way this is disappointing. I think many of us would like to think that in the wake of such destruction, structural inequalities and inadequacies could be corrected for and fixed.
And that's sort of true to my experience with the documents that I was working with. I think that is in part, trying to deal with a lot of these narratives that imagine that these moments of intense destruction can be ones, where new possibilities can crop up. And, my argument, which has, been made by others, although I'm trying to be sort of unique, making it in the information space, is that it often actually reinforces the sort of strength of those who are already dominant, who are already in power, because they are the ones that are able to recover most easily. And they're the ones who are able to sort of build back, low resource organizations, low resource people are the most dramatically affected. They don't have other resources often to fall back on. And they are sort of at the mercy of these, state welfare programs and other philanthropic projects. It absolutely sort of reinforces a particular order. Having said that, that's also really inscribed in the way we do our disaster planning in the U.S. Our plans are very much to restore what was there before. The plans are not to sort of like, let's rethink how power is distributed in the city after an earthquake, right? It's very much to restore things to what it was before. So that's sort of very much part of the disaster plans today. And, you know, colleagues in the disaster management space who really have been arguing, you know, folks in geography in particular have been arguing for a long time that we need to really rethink that orientation, because a lot of our sort of current programs and plans are great for restoring the middle class to being the middle class, but really don't do much for the resource folks. And that we actually should have a renewed focus on sort of equity and equality and thinking through our disaster planning projects today.
Well, so to go back to 1906, two things that are present there that weren't beforehand, or at least so much, was the Red Cross and then a much stronger presence by the government. How did this change the way information moved?
Yeah, so I mean, the focus of my 1906 chapter, and all, you know, all of these chapters, I had to sort of whittle down to some focus because there's infinite things that you can talk about. So the 1906 chapter, I'm really trying to understand how people found each other, and after this earthquake displaced so many people, so it's, you know, 200,000 people, half the population of San Francisco, the biggest city on the West Coast at that time. So the project of the 1906 chapter is to understand how that happened. And to the extent that the federal government and the Red Cross played a role in this sort of accounting for people and accounting for what happened, you know, the federal government, you know, had a presence and a particularly large military presence in San Francisco at the time. You sort of see and there's a lot that's written about whether there was martial law in San Francisco after the earthquake or not. And I don't sort of deal with that specifically in the book, but you do see the presence of many of these generals and others who are heavily involved in organizing the federal disaster response at the time. The Red Cross had a, you know, sort of like a quasi-governmental organization with strong relations to the Department of War at the time. So a lot of the response that you see in San Francisco is sort of largely run through the military, the sort of federal response is largely run through the military and the Department of War vis-a-vis the Red Cross. So with regards to this problem of how did people find each other and account for what had happened, you know, the Red Cross is very instrumental in thinking about how to provide relief to the San Franciscans who were affected by the earthquake. And my focus is really on thinking about how they basically counted all of these people who were displaced. My argument is, so there's been some really nice work in this field recently by Marion Moser-Jones, who's written the history of the Red Cross, and Andrea Davies, who's done a really nice book called Saving San Francisco, which is about San Franciscans, and particularly sort of poor San Franciscans after the 1906 earthquake and their experiences in relief camps. So my work is really trying to sort of build on the nice work that they've already done with this focus on the informational activities of the Red Cross. So let's see, I thought a lot about how the leader of the Red Cross at that time, the leader of the response of the Red Cross in San Francisco, this fellow Devine, how he collaborated with a Berkeley business professor named Carl Copping Plenn on creating a registration system. And this was based on Devine's study of the 1871 Chicago fires. And they devised a system where they sort of subdivided the city. And again, you can sort of, So Plenn had experience directing the census in the Bay Area. And so he was sort of very used to this project of counting San Franciscans, and the history of the 1900 census is quite interesting because he's sort of very dedicated to counting every single person. And he, you know, even to the point of putting census counters outside of boarding houses around San Francisco where sort of transient migrant workers were living in order to try to force them to be counted. Sending census counters into Chinatown at the time and trying to count all of the folks there. Chinatown was quarantined at this point. So he's got this history of trying to really be able to count every single person in the Bay Area and using somewhat extreme tactics to do it. So we have Plen with his history of census work and Divine with his history of charity work and particularly studying the Chicago fires, getting together to create this registration system that they're determined is going to be very complete, is going to find all of these people and make sure that everybody is only getting one portion of food and there was also this huge concern at the time of being pauperized, that somehow by receiving aid, people are going to stop working and just be living off of the state. So with those sort of twin concerns of both knocking on everybody's door and finding everybody and ensuring that all San Franciscans are going to return to work and they won't be pauperized by receiving aid after their houses have been destroyed and they have no access to work. So they divide the system where they're going to divide the city into parts. They're going to, send these registration takers into the various parts of the city. They're going to centralize the relief operations. And they're basically going to figure out how to account for each person and ensure that they receive their sort of fair share.
Sure. Well, and so in that trajectory or this tendency, the bureaucratization of disaster response explodes hugely over the course of the 20th century and brings us up to 1989. So what do you mean by the bureaucratization of the information system and what does that look like?
Yeah. So, I mean, of course, during the Cold War, we see this enormous growth of civil defense and the story is when civil defense workers don't end up having these nuclear attacks to work with, they start turning their attention to other ways that they can be useful. And you see throughout the 50s, particularly in California, the civil defense sort of projects start turning their attention to what does it mean to respond to a disaster? And so you see this immense reach of federal bureaucracy into local communities vis-a-vis the civil defense program throughout the 1950s. And so by the time 1989 rolls around, and we're sort of at our third historical moment in this book, there's this very sophisticated set of disaster response plans from all the way at the federal level to the state level to counties and then to, very small, even towns, have these very sophisticated disaster response plans in place. And they're sort of meant to imagine what the space is going to be like after these disasters occur and prescribe the actions of what county and state and local employees are supposed to be doing. One thing that's important to note is, so in 1950, we see the Stafford Act in the United States, and this is the first really, the most important really formal sort of set of procedures for doing this kind of emergency response work. It enables governments to spend money and use resources in different ways than they ordinarily would because of the extreme circumstances that they're dealing with. And it also sets in motion, we sort of see this throughout the sort of history of the U.S., this idea that local communities are really responsible for crisis response, but if they are overwhelmed, if their resources are overwhelmed, then they may sort of call in the county, and if the county is overwhelmed, they may call in the state, and if the state is overwhelmed, they may call in the federal government. And with the growth of this huge bureaucracy to provide assistance after emergencies. It also creates these interesting incentives for people to declare emergencies because it enables the use of resources, of sort of larger pools of resources at the state and federal level if they're sort of formally declared emergencies using Stafford Act. And that's really important from an informational perspective because that means all of a sudden you have all of these other actors that are involved in sort of producing this emergency and producing this emergency response. And so, yeah, as you noted, throughout the Cold War, there's this huge growth in government activity after disaster. And this isn't just in providing aid. It's, of course, really in being the authority and defining what has happened in the public space. And so in 1989, very much in step with the rest of the sort of Cold War ideology around media, the government imagines that it's going to be the producer of information, that the media is going to be this unproblematic conduit to the public, and that the public will be the sort of willing receivers of information. This very, much following kind of old school communication theory models. Of course, this is not what happens after the 89 earthquake. But from an informational perspective, what's really bound up in this project is this notion of public information, and public information is this sort of idealized, again, government-generated, here's what you should do now to the public sort of ideal. And again, in the 89 earthquake, when we look at what actually happened, it's, of course, far more complicated. Rather than generating the story themselves, the government is very much learning about what happened from the media and reacting based on that. The media, of course, sees the government as excellent sources for what's going on, but the state officials are mostly being informed by what the media is saying. So you have this sort of twisted relationship where they're kind of repeating each other over and over again. One interesting thing I point out in that chapter is the newspaper that won the Pulitzer Prize for reporting on the earthquake, the San Jose Mercury News, a study that was undertaken of the types of sources that the San Jose Mercury News used showed that they relied primarily on scientists and sort of non-expert, non-professional disaster responder, ordinary public type people in their reporting at a disproportionate rate than other newspapers in the area. So importantly, and this becomes important as you looked at the contemporary case today, the ideas of this ideal of public information and production of this authoritative account of what is going to and what happened after an earthquake really does not involve the public as a producer of information or as people with any sort of authoritative knowledge about what's happened. And a lot of the more recent work in the last two decades is in the disaster studies space has really underscored that the real, quote unquote, real first responders in a disaster are the people who are living through it. But that sort of insight is notably absent when we think about how the 1989 earthquake response was imagined.
Sure. Now, social media enthusiasts and techno-utopians would say that this is exactly what things like Twitter and Facebook correct for, that now we can all be our own reporters and submit our own eyewitness accounts. How do you see the way that this is preparing us for the next big earthquake?
Yeah, and so I really tried to explore that dichotomy between the states who sort of sees themselves as an authoritative voice after disasters versus this, the sort of utopian, everybody has a voice on social media platforms. In my chapter where I'm thinking through, my sort of more humanistic chapter, looking at the information order that's in place today, that there's this interesting dialectical relationship between those ideals. But in fact, the state is also very present on social media. Interestingly, social media does allow them to be, you know, social media is the kind of unproblematic conduit that the media, you know, the media is not. The media does not simply tell you exactly what government response officials want them to say. You know, they'll put it in context, maybe question it. Whereas, you know, Twitter and Facebook and these other platforms really do allow state officials to say exactly what they want to the public. And, you know, meanwhile, of course, the public is out there producing stories about what happened. But there are these huge, well, so let's see, two things. One is that, you know, the social media sites in the state are very much intertwined, despite having these sort of seemingly opposite philosophical positions on producing stories about what's happened. The state is using these sites to broadcast their public information messages, and simultaneously, the state. And so, you know, this is sort of as we get into the story about today. So in 89, the state is primarily concerned with this idea of producing public information. When we get into the contemporary era, we see there's this shift in that the public is no longer imagined to be this sort of stupid passive entity. It is in many of the Cold War era imaginings of post-disaster response. And they very much do see, oh yes, they're using the social media and they are closer to what's happened oftentimes than we are. And so we see this idea of situational awareness really cropping up over the last couple of decades in disaster response plans. And of course, social media starts to be a real source for situational awareness. And situational awareness is this idea that you know, somebody far away can understand what's happening on the ground through, and again, this is sort of harkening back to the Katrina stuff that we were talking about at the beginning. You know, if only they have the right information that's, you know, processed and displayed to them the right way, they can make the right decisions. And I'm using a lot of like scare quotes here. Make the right decisions. And so, you know, these social media platforms become a real source for for these disaster responders to be able to imagine that they understand what's happening on the ground and deploy resources accordingly. You know, I think so the chapter on the 89 Loma Prieta earthquake spent a lot of time thinking about how the dominant public information infrastructures really overplayed the damage of the 89 earthquake in affluent, mostly white areas of San Francisco, to the detriment of some of the much more adversely affected areas of California that were closer to the epicenter of the earthquake, namely Watsonville, California, which had a population that included many, many non-English speaking migrant workers. And that the sort of media's fascination with the spectacle of what was happening in San Francisco, in this, you know, sort of particular public information, organization of institutions in this, dominant public information infrastructure, really privileged those accounts and ignored the accounts of, these folks in Watsonville. Meanwhile, the Spanish language media and community groups that had been working with these migrant populations really did highlight the experiences of those people and drew it. You know, they were the first to draw attention to the horrible damage that had occurred there and try to argue that, you know, resources needed to be deployed there. They were the people who made resources. You know, sort of in the weeks after the earthquake, were the folks that made resources available to non-English speaking workers in Watsonville by translating forms and sort of enabling a sort of translation of a lot of the state projects for these people who, you know, really did not fit into what was imagined to be somebody who would need help because they were not English speaking. They lived in housing situations that were not your sort of nuclear family standard single family home situations. They were, you know, renters. They were multi-generational households and all of these sort of non-standard or sort of non-standard by the standards of the government, you know, ways of being did not fit neatly into aid forms and other ways of accessing resources. And so, you know, and this sort of bears a similarity to like when we think about today and the use of social media platforms in these, in disaster response, that we don't, you know, these often don't include people like the elderly, like people who can't afford the sort of high costs of, you know, maintaining the internet on their phone. You know, these don't include the people who are, you know, in the most damaged areas where cell phone towers may not work. And so, you know, these sort of sit to the extent that social media can be imagined to represent what happened or used to understand to be the situational awareness. It creates this sort of huge gaping holes. And so, yeah, so, you know, the book is really trying to draw attention to the ways in which the configurations of, again, these sort of heterogeneous networks really create massive gaps in how you can know what's going on or imagine that you know what's going on.
Yeah, and there's also a large geographic factor in this as well, as we see in the contrast of Hurricane Harvey in Texas and Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, where it was so much harder to get on the ground information from Puerto Rico than Harvey, and this had reverberations through the disaster response.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, just thinking about the recent wildfires in California, you know, you literally, you know, cell phone towers were burning in the areas that people really needed to be able to communicate the most. And, it, you know, it's very, very depressing. But when you look at the lists of, you know, who died during the, you know, the fires, the campfire in California, it's primarily, you know, elderly people over the age of 60. And, you know, one has to imagine that if you were to sort of reduce a lot of your disaster communication to social media tools, that these folks aren't necessarily using them. Yeah.
Sure. And so as we're heading into the age of the Anthropocene, of climate change, and disaster yeah. seems to be so much more frequent and present, what do you foresee developing in the next few decades?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, so I've tried to sort of provide some conceptual ways to think about this in the book with this concept of event epistemology, which is really thinking about the ways information order and disasters as, you know, events that, you know, occur on the ground, co-construct these possibilities for knowing. Yeah, I think it's really vital that we think about, you know, the earth and as sort of an actant as we really think through the creation of or the sort of what information orders will look like in the wake of climate change. So that's sort of one piece that I've definitely been trying to think through.
Well, and I think there's also the matter of the huge presence of a small number of very large social media platforms and their power to determine and dictate how these are responded to.
It's really terrifying because, yes, and I mean, I think while FEMA and these other government organizations are not perfect, you know, in theory, They're based in these democratic institutions that the people have some control over. And it's very troubling when public welfare projects sort of fall in the hands of these private institutions that, you know, that's just not what their primary job is. And in the final chapters of the book, I write about projects like Facebook's Safety Check, where you see Facebook sort of wrapping themselves in the sort of cloak of doing humanitarian work by ostensibly, quote unquote, responding to disasters. And you see these sort of like breathless articles in publications such as Wired declaring that, you know, Facebook is changing the face of disaster response. And it's absolutely terrifying because we have no stakes in, you know, how they're thinking about public welfare. We have no ability to see inside of the algorithms which they're using to. So Facebook has actually created a new product since I completed the manuscript of the book called Disaster Maps, which are these maps that show where people who are affected by disasters are. But of course, it's through the eyes of Facebook. We don't know what kind of algorithms they're using to generate these imaginings of these disaster publics. I think it's very alarming for all of us. I leaned heavily on this concept of calculated publics from Charlton Gillespie, where he talks, you know, he's sort of writing about, okay, well, what kind of publics are being generated by these social media platforms? And, you know, we sort of don't know who's included. We don't know who's not included. We don't know what their primary concerns are. I think incredibly disturbingly, you know, Facebook allows people to run, to sort of run these campaigns to get donations for people who are affected by disasters afterwards. But Facebook takes a percentage of the donations that are made. Mm. I think we should be all asking big questions about what
happened. Well, it is an exciting time to be going into and to be thinking about these questions. So what is your next project then?
Oh boy. So I have a couple projects I've been working on that fall out of the book that have been really fun collaborations for me to work on. Working on a project with Mike Anani at USC's Annenberg, looking at how journalists are making use of scientific data, which has been a lot of fun. I'm working with an anthropologist who studies, you know, seismicity in Mexico, named Beth Reddy. And she and I have been thinking through a lot of these issues we were just talking about around sort of media and materiality and the politics of life on these social media platforms. I've been working with a colleague at University of Washington named Scott Miles on something we're calling seismic cultures, where we're thinking about what it's like for various peoples around the Pacific Rim to live with earthquakes and how the sort of practices and politics of living in earthquake with earthquakes differs around the rim. And we've been staging various sort of public projects around this. So we just had a booth at the Seattle Design Festival this fall that was kind of asking Seattleites what it would be like, you know, what their life is like living in a place with seismicity, and asking them to think with some of the ideas from like Japan and Chile. And then my next big book project, I'm tentatively titling Inconvenient Data. And it's really thinking about how data sets about, you know, generated by scientists using new instrumentation and new methods sort of shape and construct the places that we live in and the various institutions that make these data sets meaningful or visible or not. My sort of big projects I'm thinking through right now.
Well, that's a lot on your palate, and they also
it's been really fun.
Yeah. Well, Megan Finn, thank you so much for taking this time to talk to me.
Thank you so much. This was really fun.